Hello, everybody. It's Jughead. And if you are listening to this in real time, I hope you had a Merry Christmas, a Happy Holiday, and or a great New Year's Eve and day. I'd like to start off right at the top by thanking my patrons at Patreon. If you want to join, just go to www.jugheadsbasementpodcast.com and you'll see a little button there that says Patreon. You could follow that and it'll whiz you to a new location. The people we have coming in this week, we have two at the $5 a month donation tier. Actually, they both paid for a full year, which is a great option that you can do that gets it off your mind and helps me out dramatically. The names are Jesse Kramer, and I don't think this is this person's real name, but we know them as Satan's Little Monkey. So thank you, Jesse and Satan's Little Monkey. At the $2 range, we have Mark Krikorian, or Krikorian. Let me know. This Patreon really does help me out, and building it over the years has been great. I'm now in my 11th year of doing the podcast, and if you have been freeloading for 11 years, maybe it is your time to give for a month or two. If not, of course, I don't mind. I just want you to listen to the program and hear these people talk. And if you don't have the cash, I understand that too, but you can also help out by sharing the podcast on all your social networks, or you can write a review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. You can subscribe on YouTube or subscribe at the Podomatic site. There's lots of different things you can do. You can also give a one-time donation at PayPal. Just go to PayPal or to the website and you can give a donation to jugheadsbasement@gmail.com at any denomination from 2 cents to $6 trillion. I have been sitting on this interview for a while. I did a few while I was in Japan, and I think I stated in here or I've stated in others that my Airbnb had moved us across town, and we were stationed now in front of a train station, so it was very loud, and I had to do these interviews in a closet. So I make reference to that in a lot of the upcoming and latest and earlier podcasts. I also want to state here that I don't usually mention this, but Bruce is very, very honest in this podcast and brought up some things he may not have shared before. So I would like to say that there is some explicit material in this podcast. And if you are sensitive to that, I wanted to acknowledge the appearance of some of the topics in this particular episode. And as always, you are free to email me to ask questions or to comment on things. I really do appreciate that correspondence. And you can do that even more so if you become a patron. I have also one more announcement at the end. Bruce makes reference to a re-release of all of their records, and you have an opportunity to be the winner of the full collection that he sent to me. I will have that at the end after the outgoing song. So without any further ado, let's do it. Right now, you are listening to God Bless America by Toxic Reasons, originally released on 7-inch in 1984. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Jughead's Basement, episode 158 of Lo-Fi Interviews with Hi-Fi Guests, this week with Bruce Stuckey of Toxic Reasons. In this episode, he talks to us about Aldo Giorgini and the Intelligent Offspring, working with Paul Mahern of Zero Boys, punk in the Ronald Reagan age, cynicism, idealism, and political bands, discussion of rebellion and Bruce's challenging upbringing, repercussions of asking your audience to burn it all down, Tufty and JJ and their daily lives together, Bruce and Jughead share independent album design woes and accomplishments. Plus, we don't need any other reason than Toxic Reasons. More. Let's do it!
Hey!
Hey!
Have you been waiting for me for like 8 minutes or something?
Nine.
Nine? Shit, I'm sorry. I didn't realize it was 8 o'clock already.
Oh, that's fine. It doesn't matter, right? Yeah, look at us with the stylish gray hair.
Bam! There you go. And dentures and everything else, right?
Yeah, you got the dentures going. I'm not there yet. Yeah, no, I noticed that I watched an interview of you guys in Europe. You were doing some interviews when you did a show there a couple years ago, and I could see it. Were those freshly new dentures at that time?
Oh yeah,
my roommate just got all of his teeth removed and dentures put in, and he's dealing with that sort of struggle of learning how to chew food again. And
how long ago was that?
He got his in last year. So
it's going to take him a little bit longer.
Yeah.
I mean, just learning how to sing without spitting my teeth out was incredibly difficult.
Wow. Well, it's punk. It's punk as shit.
Yeah, picking your teeth up out the mosh pit, right?
Yeah. So thank you, Bruce, for doing this. My conditions are kind of strange. I'm in Japan right now because I'm visiting my girlfriend and. And the Airbnb switched our locations and put me right near a train. So I'm in my closet now to
try. Oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. So, okay. But I built this little studio in the closet pretty quick. And there's a lot of trains that go by because I'm at a hub in Osaka. But luckily, Zoom does a split recording. So every time you're talking, I can mute myself if there's like a train going by. So.
Oh, that's fine.
If you happen to hear that while you're talking, don't worry about it.
That's all crap you got to deal with, right?
Yeah, that's all crap I'll deal with. But sometimes it gets on the mind of the person who's talking. You're like, oh my God, I'm talking and all I hear is noise.
Yeah, I'm just starting doing my first music video I've ever done. And I'm realizing what a real pain in the ass all this editing and everything is.
Yeah. Oh, you're doing it yourself, like in iMovies or something?
I'm working with some gal from work. She's doing the filming stuff for me. We're, you know, you got to piece it all together. I already recorded the music and everything, but it's a lot of work. I didn't realize how much work that was.
Yeah. I dabbled in it a bit. Me and Ben, who started Screeching Weasel, we dabbled in it a bit way back in the 80s when we were doing like, you know, you would take your actual digital tape. You would take like actual negatives and chop it together.
Slides. Yeah. That must have been 10 times harder.
Yeah, it was crazy work. But, you know, a lot of that was, you know, I don't know. There's something about working that way, too, where you have to do it like in the moment live. Digital, there's so much. You almost get obsessed with perfection because you could just take as much time as you want. Yeah,
it's different when you can. Isn't that different?
Yeah, recording studio is a lot like that.
If I spend another 20 minutes on this could look fucking tight as hell. Yeah. So you do it and then you realize I just did that 4 times on 4 different shots. And now the day's over. I got to get out of here. You know what I mean?
I wouldn't say we had battles over, but it was one of those. It seems to be one of those things, especially in punk rock, where it bounces between wanting some kind of perfection, but then thinking maybe you're modeling prog rock too much. And then you try to bounce back to being as raw as possible. And then when the digital came to age, it was a little bit difficult because you got really, at least I did with Master Genie, got really obsessed with the silencing between drum hits and, you know, all that shit.
Mass is so fucking good at that, you know what I mean?
Yeah, he is very good.
Right. And if you just got to shut up and let him do his thing.
I do. I know. I've been friends with him since, I think in '85 is when we started corresponding. You know, we played Spud Zero a little bit later there.
Yeah, we met him through his, you know, from his dad.
Oh, you met? Yeah. You know, Aldo. What a.
Yeah, he used to bring the guys. You know, him and Mass and Flop to the shows. You know, he would drive Rat Tail Grenadier around and stuff. He was like their manager, roadie.
Yeah, he was a great guy. He got really close to our band too. And actually, one of our covers of our records is Art of Aldo Giorgini. Art for the cover of it.
Aldo Giorgini, born March 15th, 1934, died in October 1994. He was an Italian artist and a pioneer in computer graphics. He is the father of music producer Mass Giorgini and Flav Giorgini, both my friends. And I misspoke. I actually met Mass a little bit later, around 87, during the release of Screeching Weasel's first demo tape. Back to Bruce and me.
Aldo, I thought he was just the best. I mean, he was just the best. He was the nicest guy. I guess that's what happens to somebody that's a genius. They get brain cancer, right?
Yeah, that's the irony of it. Yeah. It's very, yeah. I mean, Mass is pretty open about it. I actually had a podcast where he talked about his family and how smart, intelligent, you know, Flav's working on DNA and stuff and trying to dissolve Alzheimer's. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a fucking genius. Like my older brother's as a fucking physicist, you know what I mean? I'm just a douchebag punk rocker that makes tacos.
I took a lot of notes over time, Bruce, but also a couple of years ago, I learned this new I've been doing this for about 10 years, but I learned this new process of kind of ditching the notes a little bit, but still keep being the arbiter of the direction. And I've gotten pretty good at interviewing, but it does open it up for you taking it in the directions you want, and I'll rein it in if it gets out of control.
You just, this is your thing, dude. I have no idea what you wanted to talk about or why you even wanted to talk to me in the first place.
Well, to be honest, Bruce, you've always been an influence on me since I'm surprised even I remember back then, but in, I think it was what I wrote it down is 88. You guys played a thrash fest that I put on with my friend at Dirty Nelly's in Chicago or Palatine. And you were with Zero Boys and Sloppy Seconds, and you were touring with KGB from Germany.
Yeah.
And you played with Operation Ivy, which were that who no one knew who they were at that time.
No, they didn't. No, I didn't.
But I remember I did the sound for you because in those days you did whatever. It wasn't your specialty. You just did whatever you could, and you actually complimented me on my sound. So I always remember that.
If you made it sound good, that was a hard fucking job. I don't know what to tell you. You know, there's always that. You know, you go to a Toxic Reasons gig. I always tell somebody, it's like, oh, something's going to be out of tune or something's going to break, and you know, it's just inevitable. You just walk up on stage and smack your guitar and detune it and tune it back up just to get it out of the way.
Yeah, well, I through interviews I've seen you talk, Bruce, and I hear your music, and I don't know, there's a little bit of self-deprecation in all of punk rock, but I would really acquaint with you with being some of the more good musicians in punk rock, like you and Tufty and JJ are all pretty.
We were very rehearsed.
Yeah.
I mean, because you can't go in a studio if you don't have less than $2,000 to record an album. You gotta have that shit fucking rehearsed. You know, you can't go in a studio and dick around.
Did you think you kind of knew that right from the beginning? Like, I know you worked with Paul Mahern on Independence. I think you worked on a comp with him before that, and then he had time in that studio, so he brought you guys in.
We did. It was the compilation I'm just looking at now. It's called The Master Tape.
The Master Tape. Yeah. Yeah. I couldn't find it online. I couldn't remember what it was called. Yeah.
Hello, this is John in the future. And for the audio listener, this might help you. But behind Bruce, he has actually all of his albums, vinyl records, framed. And he refers to them often in this podcast. It is a very impressive looking selection behind him.
We did our first album with him. And this other guy's name just escapes me. Just it's John something at the moment. And then and Paul did our third album. And then he did the Dedication album and the Bulls for You album. He did a lot of stuff with us.
In general, Paul has done a lot of stuff. Yeah.
He
even worked with a fucking John Cougar Mellencamp, who is actually I'm actually a huge fan of John Cougar. So
yeah.
Well, it's crazy. You get all over the place when you.
Yeah, he's a lot more accomplished than I am in the recording stuff. I just, rehearse it, make sure I wasn't fucking my parts up. But then you get there and you listen to it and go, shit, I don't have any, I can't afford any nice equipment or anything like that. So it just sounded the way it sounded, which was 9 times out of 10 crappy.
This reminds me of I don't play with Weasel anymore, but there's influences all over the world. And sometimes people call me up and say, hey, why don't you do like a cover band of yourself? So they'll fly me out. Like I went to Costa Rica, and the idea of what I tell them is I'll learn half your songs. You learn half of my songs. And
there you go.
And I was surprised how many times I've gone to a place and I knew everything more than they did. Like there was this perception of punk rock that it was supposed to be rough and like not rehearsed. And I just wonder how you related to that coming up and being a pretty well rehearsed band from the beginning, it seems.
Yeah, well, you can't go in the studio. You can't pay for that. We had to pay cash for these albums and we had to be done in like a week.
Yeah. Do you think that's the only reason, or do you just want to sound good live too? Is it really just about the studio?
I would purposely write songs with all these little bits into them because you'd have to rehearse them. But when you're playing it live, you go, wow, these guys are really tight. So, well, you have to be tight or you can't play this fucking song. You know what I'm saying? You get there's a couple of songs on like the Dedication album and stuff. That's like five little breaks in it. They're 2 measures long each, right next to each other. And they're all completely different, but they all flow together. And if you fuck up one chord or one note, it ruins the whole fucking thing.
Yeah. That's funny how even the how fast or slow you're playing something can completely change the feeling of a song. I always thought that was bizarre how that that happens.
Everything I've been doing different music now. My own stuff. It's completely different than the Toxic Reason stuff. But it's everything makes a difference. What choice of what instrument you're going to use and what part and what tempo it's going to be at, tone and everything it makes. And now for the first time in my life since I started doing my own stuff, I've taken over a year just to do 6 songs, and that's just piddling around with just me.
Are you doing all the instruments on it?
I'm doing everything. It's just me, and it's, you know, it's me rapping.
Yeah. Would you consider it a genre, or you're just sort of playing around and just whatever comes out comes out?
No, it's kind of like trying to just describe it to people. It's kind of like I got the idea from watching music trailers during the lockdown.
Mm-hmm.
I would watch like 2 hours of music trailers, you know, upcoming science fiction movies for the, you know, next
yeah,
year.
Yeah.
And they're all like 3 or 4 minutes long. It's like the length of it. It's like watching a music video. But I started listening to the music and it was really engrossing. It was because they've only got 3 minutes to get you, you know, and you got to go to the movie, right? So I started calling it cinematic punk rap.
Yeah.
And that's the only way I can describe it. But it's really political and cultural because of the environment that we live in right now. And I've always been political and cultural, so I couldn't help it. But I found out that, you know, instead of just screaming and yelling, doing like No Pity and Destroyer and all that stuff, I would just bust some bars, have some fun. I've actually had tons of fun writing these songs. I mean, it's just tons of fun. And I put them on my Facebook page, and then I just started a YouTube channel. I just threw the songs up there and haven't really made a big deal about it yet. I'm going to wait till I get done with this video and...
You just barely touched on something that I actually did have down as a question. And I know a lot of my people that listen to the program, it does pretty well now. Like even people that don't know punk rock will listen to it. I, you know, I have anywhere from 1,000 to 5,000 people that follow each episode. I like to give a little, I don't know, a little look at the time period. So I want to talk a little bit about the move from Ohio to Indianapolis. I know it's only 3 hours, but like, is there a difference to me? I remember when we toured Dayton, I had this image in my head that it was like a drug town, something, some perception it got for me from those days. I don't even know. It's like a stereotypical thing, but that whenever we went to Dayton, it was like crazy. Like,
when NCR had closed and Frigidaire was, you know, laying all these people off and everything, then yeah, you kind of get that West Virginia weird, just the whole West Virginia drug thing going on, you know, when they closed down all the coal plants and everything and everybody just fucking turned into fucking heroin addicts. And you kind of got that same feeling about, I guess, Dayton. But it was just more of a suburban drug hole. Does that make sense? There was a lot of hard drugs going on there, but I couldn't afford them. So I lived. You know what I mean? But when I got older, I started traveling around. Because we didn't really just go from Dayton to Indianapolis. I mean, we went from Dayton to California. Came back to Dayton and went over there. And I can't remember. We settled down here in Indianapolis in 84. Yeah, after we'd already gone to Europe one time, I believe.
In the wiki, it says it's around 79 when you first started playing. Is that what you would say, or is it formed as a band a little bit later than that? Is that an accurate date?
I would have been 19, and I'd already played in a shitty band before that. Before there was, you know, punk rock had been invented, and played in a band and found punk rock and just fell in love with that. But it was 79. And I remember we saw DOA when they played, and it was a 3-piece. And I told him, I said, when you guys come back, we're going to have a band. I'm going to open for you. Came back and we did. We had a band. We opened for them, you know?
Yeah, your careers are pretty tied together for quite a while, you and the DOA. Right?
That's because they didn't know how to tell us to fuck off. We were like going, so where's your next show? They're, oh, it's going to be in Kentucky or something. They go, will you play? They go, sure. Bam, there we are. We're playing with them. Next thing they know, they're like, well, how do we get rid of these fuckers? You know what I mean? We scammed on all their goddamn shows.
Well, you even got JJ, a drummer.
Well, that was. I honestly think that Joey Shithead did that just to get us out of their fucking practice room, because we had gone to Vancouver and played a show with DOA and Dead Kennedys at the Commodore Ballroom. We opened the show, of course. You know, Ed Pittman that night or the next morning punched our drummer in the head. Drummer said "fuck you" and quit and flew back home. So we got stuck. We stayed in DOA's practice place for a couple of months.
Wow, that long?
We didn't have a drummer. Where were we gonna go? I took the money we made from that show, which was like $150 or some shit like that. It wasn't a lot. Bought a 50-pound bag of potatoes and some fryer grease, and we just lived in their place. We scammed on every fucking, I don't know what you call it, every meal scammed from our colleges and stuff, you know, free meals and stuff like that. We'd go in there and take a student ID and eat, and but we kept trying to find a drummer and all this crap. And finally we got a hold, you know, got, we met JJ, and he said, yeah, I'll play drums for you guys for a minute. You know what I mean? I don't want to tell you all the circumstances. I'll JJ tell you that to you sometime.
Yeah, no, I can actually link to it because I'll have a site with other. And he actually talks quite a bit about thinking that you were just going to be, he was going to be a roadie for your guys, and then discovered that you wanted him to play drums.
He also, you know, he came over to practice after he first played with us. And Ron Reveas, the guy used to sing with Black Flag, who works for a catering company in Vancouver, just popped by because the DOA guy said these guys are hungry and dropped off all this catering, right?
Yeah.
And Jay's just like, well, these guys are living large. Catering and practice. And it's like, he's like, no, we just, you know, we just got lucky that day. You just happened to be here. It was so funny because the first three shows he did with us was with like the Dead Kennedys and Black Flag and some other massive band. I forget who it was. And he's like, hey, you want to stay? You want to join the band? He's like, sure, fine. This is fucking great. This is going to be great. It's like, you get $2 a day to live on.
That was your per diem, huh? Didn't even call it per diem then. Probably just, here's just money.
That's what we called it. You had to make light of it somehow, just to make it more palatable.
Yeah,
get through your day, right? But you know, you chip it everybody together. There's like five guys and $2 a piece. There's $10, right? Get yourself a little pouch of that shitty Bull Durham tobacco for 50 cents, and then buy a can of beans. Somebody else buy some bread or some tortillas and stuff, and that would be what you'd eat for the entire fucking day. Unless you know, you go to the show and everybody had drugs, everybody had booze, nobody ever had a fucking bologna sandwich. You know what I mean?
Mm. In when Weasel, we used to tour with, we used to just get a jar of peanut butter and just basically just eat that for days.
Yeah. I remember when we got up, God, it was like the third time out or something, we went up to $5 a day.
Whoa.
Bam. All of a sudden, everybody's like going, they got to come to the store, but you're coming out with a pack of marbles. Yeah, Marble Reds. Yeah, it's fucking cool.
Yeah, food will happen somehow.
Well, the good thing about cigarettes is it kills your appetite because it just makes you sick.
Well, the questions that come out of there is something. Watching the band and seeing, you know, you've had different members coming in and out over time, but it seems like JJ and Tufty have stuck around for a long time. But and I don't know how to get to the root of this question, but I wanted to try to hit it seriously. You're so early in the beginning of punk rock that there probably is still the remnants of how a rock band would work. Like it seems bizarre to me that all of you would move around and live different places together. And I even think as of the 80s, like when we started, someone moved away, you would just get rid of them. It seemed there was still a sense of, I don't know, like whether you were going to make it. Do you know what I'm trying to get at? It seems like it comes more from the rock world than what punk turned into.
That's, I think, yeah. How do I say this without sounding like a flipping piece of shit? It's all fucking pop music, dude. All right? It is. I don't care how it starts out and everyone's so committed. We were the same. I was the same. It was always, you know, fuck this and fuck that. And it's all full of shit. But you're fucking 22 years old. You know what I mean? You're 19, 20, 22, 23, 25. Eventually, especially for me, because I never got out of that cycle of what I was doing until I was 24, when I actually had got a job and said, well, yeah, I could pay the bills. I'm not living in a truck. I'm not living in a warehouse. I'm not a homeless person. Because that's what I was. I was a homeless person. You know what I mean? You know, you live in a truck, you're a fucking homeless person. You're traveling around, you're a transient. You know, we didn't live anywhere. I didn't live anywhere for shit for 4 years. You finally, see, I've met somebody. I got to get a job. I got to pay, help pay the bills. And your perception changes. It's like, oh, what are you writing these songs for? Because I want to fucking burn it all fucking down. You know, that's in a couple of my old songs back in the day, right? You get a little bit older, you go like, well, that's fucking stupid as fuck. What are you going to replace it with? Are you strong enough to go out there and beat the shit out of somebody and take their can of beans away from them, eat their fucking dog? You know, I don't think so. That's not me. There has to be a sense of order to get shit done. I mean, one time I was sitting there with a roadie, Bob Kramer, love him to death. We were tripping in the van. I don't know where we got the acid from, but we were fucking just tripping balls. And this happened back in the very early 80s. And I was looking at a can of beer. I said, dude, what the fuck goes into making this can of beer? And we sat there for like an hour while we were tripping, just breaking down every fucking thing that goes, I mean, to the roads, the cars, the infrastructure, this and that. And finally came to the conclusion that if you burned it all down, it would take us 100 years before we could make another can of fucking beer. It just gets stupid. And it's so involved, and it's taken us, I don't know how many hundreds of years to get to this point, but we finally gotten to the point now, and now we're running around saying, burn it all down again.
It's interesting because I feel like, Bruce, I can ask you questions about now that are similar to what I would ask you during like the Reagan era.
Ronald Reagan was a shit. We played a show in Detroit at his first, when he was first running for president at the Republican National Convention in Detroit City. And that would have been 1980. Play with DOA. I think Bad Brains was supposed to play there too. I don't know if they did or not. They were on the poster. It was a different world then for me, not America. America is exactly the fucking same now as it was then. It hasn't changed one fucking bit. Not even a little bit. It's exactly the same. You got a bunch of rich cocksuckers who just take care of them fucking selves and give a fuck about you or anything else. All they want to do is keep you bitching, moaning, whining, complaining, and blaming somebody else for your own fucking problems. That's exactly the same as it used to be then.
Now, Bruce, if you were to put on maybe your more, I don't know, you can take it a cynical direction or those moments of idealism. You know, a lot of this stuff is being re-released. A lot of your stuff is this year have been released. Well, I'm going to get to that a little bit later, but I'm going to use it as a jumping board to talk about, you've probably had to look back at this stuff and were you trying to make a change politically, or do you feel like it succeeded in any way, or does it really come down to it just being music?
No, I honestly, this is how fucking naive I am. I used to be. I honestly thought every time I would write one of those songs, you know, stage and sing, I thought I was making a fucking difference. I honestly fucking thought that. That's why I played so hard. That's why I yelled so fucking loud. I was like, God damn it. This is going to make a difference. In retrospect, now I can look back at it and go, dude, you weren't that motherfucking smart. Never went to fucking college, right? Barely got through high school. Next thing you know, I'm out being a transient bum, literally, sleeping in warehouses and record stores and not living anywhere, not making any money, not contributing to society in any fucking way, shape, or form. All I'm doing is running around bitching about it and saying we got to burn it the fuck down. And so eventually I got a little bit more introspective. And I started thinking, well, what it is that really bugs me was I didn't understand war. I would look at war because ever since I've been alive, there's been a war. There's wars going on right now. We're involved. America's involved like, I don't know, 6 or 7 wars right now. We're killing people all over the fucking world. We drop. I think the last, what was the last estimate I saw was we drop a bomb every 12 minutes someplace in the world. Or maybe it's 12 hours.
Hey, this is John in the future, and I looked up a couple sites online. So obviously, this is not the complete facts on all of this. You know, all of these different evaluations of what we have done are tallied in many different ways. But this article says that an average of 46 bombs have been dropped on other countries per day by the United States and its allies since 2001. Recent research by anti-war group Code Pink revealed this. The United States and its allies have dropped at least 326,000 bombs and missiles on other countries since 2001, including over 152,000 in Iraq and Syria.
What difference does it make? We're involved in killing people. And a lot of these people that die are civilians. We run around pointing at them, look how evil this motherfucker is, and this guy's a despot, and look what he does to his own people. It's like, look what we do to their people. Say, oh, sorry, that was a school we thought. We thought that was a weapons depot, but we just killed 150 kids. Our bad. But, you know, we're the good guys, right? That's okay. It's not okay. Everything we do is not okay. And that's when I started getting to the point when I was like, what does it take to convince a human being to kill another human being? That's what war is. How can you incense a population so much that they go, fuck these cocksuckers, I want them dead. I'm going to kill them. I'm going to kill their babies, their grandmothers. I'm going to grind them under their tank wheels, you know. Fuck them. I want them all fucking dead. What the fuck does it take to make somebody that angry at people you've never met before? I don't get it. I just don't get it. I've never gotten it.
I'd hate to be the cliche, but it's, you can build that by, you know, fear. You know, you put fear in people and they'll protect their families.
Works every time, doesn't it?
Existential thing. You know, that's what the, you know, Camus' Plague is about. You know, if you test someone to the point of this or die, it pushes people to do things they wouldn't have seen themselves doing before.
sure worked in that COVID lockdown, didn't it? Got that fear fucking thing ramped the fuck up.
Yeah.
And everybody was like hating on everybody else. Never let a good crisis go to waste, right? Isn't that what they say?
So, Bruce, some of those people, whether you think it has done good or not, like we were just talking about, Joey Shithead went into politics.
Yeah.
Jello Biafra basically was born politics. And is
yeah, he was.
did it just not seem like that was a path for you?
No. What the fuck would I do? I would just become what I hate. It didn't make any sense to me. I love Joey Shithead to death, right? And I saw the stuff he was trying to do when he... I think he's just a councilman now. I think he gave up on the run for mayor and just became a councilman member or something like that. He never spoke out about the trucker convoy up there. Not that I saw. When Justin Trudeau started freezing those people's bank accounts and stuff, I never heard him speak about that at all, which I found troubling. Because I love Joey Shithead to death. I can't imagine he would be the first person to say, hey, leave these fuckers alone. I didn't hear a word about it. That made me afraid that he could turn into a politician.
I mean, that's the trap of taking that route, is you start learning, not, I wouldn't like to say playing the game, but you're looking to get goals done. And sometimes you end up compromising things that you wouldn't think you would have compromised before.
Exactly. And I don't, it's just, I hope I'm wrong. Cause I mean, like I said, I love him to death. I hope I'm wrong, but I didn't hear a word.
Joey Keithley, better known as Joey Shithead, was running for mayor, but then he stepped out of the way of one of the other men running, Mike Hurley. But Joey is on the TransLink Mayor's Council. In the quick editing time that I have had, I could not find anything about Joey's opinion about the trucker convoy. So I can neither confirm nor disagree with what Bruce is stating here. The only closely related thing I could find is that Joey was in support of the vaccine passport.
I often question or think about rebellion and what it means. Like sometimes rebellion is just doing the opposite of what your parents had done, or, you know, or being pushed to the point of just reacting opposite. How do you see rebellion? And did you think you were growing up rebellious?
Yeah. There's a, if you only view me in the context of these records behind me, then you're going to have a completely limited perspective on who I am. It's a little different. A lot of things don't come up in conversation when you're growing up, especially when you're younger and everything's macho and everything like that, right? Testosterone, who's the biggest seal on the fucking beach and all that shit. So if you discuss certain topics, you feel that it makes you appear weak, okay? And so my rebelliousness, my family life was really fucked, all right? I mean, it was very violent. And what was that, 15, 14, 15, started doing drugs. And this is in the suburbs, right? This isn't a hardcore downtown Chicago type shit. This is in the suburbs in fucking Bellbrook, Ohio, all right? And a group of pedophiles had nestled in down the block. And these are guys in their mid to late 30s. And this is how, I didn't know, you know, I wasn't 15 years old. I didn't know this is how they operate, okay? These things really exist, and these people really exist. And this is what they do. They go set up shop in some suburban neighborhood. They're single, cool guys. They got a 1957 Thunderbird, or they, you know, convertible. They got a big giant screen projection TV. I got a beer tap in my house. I got pot. I got Quaaludes. Next thing you know, your home life is fucked. You know, your dad's getting beating the shit out of your mom. And they're screaming and crying and yelling all the fucking time. So you turn to drugs and you end up in these guys' fucking house. Well, you can imagine what happens, right? Yeah, well, that's what fucking happens. And the rebelliousness, after a while, you start going, I'm not rebelling against my parents. I mean, in hindsight, I can look back and say, yeah, I was thinking I was running. I wasn't rebelling. I was running away from them. Okay. That's completely different than rebelling against them. I mean, I stood up to my father. He came into, after my older brother beat my dad, we both pulled guns on him and we took our whole family, marched him down the street. You know where we went? We went to the house where all the pedophiles were that were abusing me and a bunch of my friends. It's just kind of difficult to talk about. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
But they I mean, fuck them. This is just how they operate. They take advantage of little kids. I mean, we were little fucking kids, right? 14, 15 years old. My brother was 16. He was driving a car. But when he, after he did that to my dad, he joined the fucking army and took off. So now I'm there by myself with my mom sleeping in my bedroom and my little brother and my little sister sleeping in their rooms. And my dad's still coming home drunk every night, kicking the fucking door off the hinges, coming in and pouring an entire bottle of perfume on my mom and going, wake up, you fucking slut, and screaming and yelling. I was finally, I must have weighed, I don't know, 90 pounds at the most, right? Mm. I get up. You leave her alone. Oh, you touch my mom again.
Oh, man.
That fucker just laughed in my face, dude. Laughed in my motherfucking face. He goes, I'll piss on your grave when you die, motherfucker. He screamed and yelled, but I stood up to him, and I was shaking like a leaf. You know what I mean? Something snapped in his head, and he just went, "Okay, well, good night." Turned off the light and left. So I mean, that's not rebelling. You know, I went through all this shit just to get to the point where I could be like, "Wow, I got to get the fuck out of here." So I moved my mom and my sister and my little brother out of Bellbrook and went to a different school when I was a junior in high school. But once again, I had to utilize the resources of the guy that was sexually abusing me, because he owned a car. He was a car salesman in a car lot, so I had to borrow one of the cars. You know, every time I do something, it's like, you owe me one, you owe me one, you owe me one. Well, you don't owe you one of the favors. The favors, you had to jerk me the fuck off. You know what I mean? It's a whole fucking different thing, and that changes the way you perceive yourself. You know what I'm saying? It just changes the way you perceive yourself. You start thinking, well, God, I'm in love with this girl from fucking high school. I mean, she's fucking all I ever fucking think about, but I got to go jerk this motherfucker off. And what do you think that does to your psyche? I mean, you're still developing.
Your identity is like scattered.
Yeah, scattered all over the place. That's why I would embrace living in a truck with five stinky guys that don't bathe but once a month, just because I'm not there anymore. I'm not dealing with my parents. I'm not dealing with my family. I'm not dealing with all this other shit. I'm there. I'm away from it. That's not rebellion. I'm sorry. It's just not. Mm. If that's how people interpret all of those songs that I wrote were me taking the quiet time of my life to try and be contemplative and introspective and think about in my limited capacity. Like I said, I struggled to get through fucking high school, dude. Taking that limited capacity and writing a song about something about I thought was troubling other than myself. I could have wrote all those albums. I could have wrote 8 albums just about the troubles in my own life, but I chose to, like, so many other people look at other things. And that's probably that's a shortfall of mine. I could have been more introspective. I could have been, I don't know, one of the ranting poets, or, you know, clicking your fingers and wacky things. You know what I mean?
Well, as one of those ranting poets who click my fingers, abstractly click my fingers, I don't, you know, it you often come to the same conclusions at the end of the day.
Yeah. Hey, yo, no, with that, my life's made of glass.
Well,
this is the first time I've ever talked to this about this publicly. But
are you sure you're going to be okay with that? You know, I'm okay. I mean, is that?
No, I don't care. I'm almost 63, dude. I don't give a fuck.
Yeah, okay.
I really don't. Well, I just don't give.
I don't want to make light of this, but I often try to make links to things, whether they're true or not, to see how the person reacts. But do you think that I'm just really interested in that? You know, you and Tufty, and even that video I see, JJ, interested in these friendships through bands that last through time. Did that help you at all? Like, did you find a community in these guys that soothed some of those beasts?
My family. This went beyond community for me.
Yeah.
I didn't discuss this with them for, at least 15 years before I discussed it with anyone. We're not even community. We're family. Me and JJ and Tufty, we're family. I work for Tufty. I mean, he owns the restaurant and bar that I work at.
Yeah, I was going to get that. It's a Revolution. It's a cantina in Indianapolis.
It's a bar that holds 250, maybe 300 people. 3 bars. There's one in the front. There's one that goes outside for the summertime. And there's one in the middle. But it's a busy freaking place. You know what I mean?
Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control.
And welcome to the middle of the show, where I get to introduce to you a podcaster that I really respect. His name is Mark Linsenmeyer, and he's been on this very show. I've been a follower of his original podcast, Partially Examined Life, And more relevant to this show, he's been doing a show on music interviews for quite a while now. I was on his, he was on mine. Nakedly Examined Music is a podcast about songs and songwriting. In each episode, Mark actually speaks with a songwriter about three of their songs, which you get to hear in full. I get to do that. We actually hashed out what three songs it was. It was actually a fun process working that part of it out. And then he digs into those songs and really... It really fills a gap, and if you are a writer yourself, to be asked such inquisitive and deep questions like he does. The show, Nakedly Examined Music, explores what motivates creative decisions at every step of a song's creation, from the initial idea to the final recording. It also provides a picture of how a songwriter's work has changed over the course of their career. That's very interesting to me. I do that myself on this show. It's very good for introducing you to new music. He and I often cross over some of our guests, so we are feeding each other different ideas on furthering our reach into genres that surround the one that we are into. And I think you're going to come away from this podcast with many new favorite songs. You're going to learn more about famous, infamous, and legendary artists, and you'll get filled in on scenes and genres that you might have felt like you should know more about. You'll probably come back a better listener and a more inspired creator. So once again, this is my friend Mark Linsenmeyer, and his podcast is called Nakedly Examined Music. And you can find it at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Johnny's got a problem and he's
out of control. I was just at JJ's house today picking up some stuff to send to you to give away to your listeners.
Oh, cool. That's great. I go back on the 10th to Chicago, so I'll be back there to
we could
exchange that.
Hang on a second. We're gonna have to be mobile for a second.
Okay, that's fine.
My dogs are being assholes. I hear you. Fucking hell. I know. It's hard to be small and fuzzy.
Are you familiar with Warren Fitzgerald from the Vandals? Do you know? Have you played with those guys?
Played with the Vandals? I never met them.
Yeah, I did an interview with Warren, and he was mobile the whole time. He says he can't think straight if he's not pacing. I felt like I was in some kind of like avant-garde movie the whole time, like this tense, shaking background.
It's a George Lynch movie. I can't take it anymore. My dogs would drive me crazy, but I love them. I live by myself. I mean, who else can put up with my shit? They just drive me crazy. Get in here. Fucking around. Wasting my time. Get in here. Well, I'm wasting my time. I'm wasting your time. You know what it's like.
That's, you know, these are the real moments for me, Bruce. This is okay.
Oh, that's cool.
Hey, I'm in a closet. Okay. What can I say? I'm in a closet.
You're getting older. Maybe it's time to come out of the closet.
Yeah.
Hello, this is John in the future. And there's a section here that I cut out because we talked about another conversation I had with somebody else. And I didn't think it proper to put in here, but it all revolved around that being in a closet joke. And this next section I'm leaving in because I think it resonates with Bruce's experiences as a child and shows that he has compassion for people who make other relationship life choices in consensual adult relationships. Ultimately, I think it goes back to Bruce saying himself that his knowledge of politics is a little less than he would like them to be, but it doesn't stop him from talking about it and trying to figure out situations. I don't want to justify what he says here, but I think it's a little bit more nuanced and complicated than it may sound. So back to the interview.
It is real world stuff. You got to take your little, you got to take your victories where you can get them. If I was gay, I would just say, give me the civil union. I want the tax breaks, right? Everything else is love. You love who you love. I don't need a piece of paper for that. I told myself I did twice, but that's a lie. It means something different to everybody. What you think love is to you is probably completely different from what it is to me because of my past and your past. You know what I mean?
I think all emotions are probably that way, even more so than other words. It's hard to, you know, it's purely subjective.
Life is purely subjective, yes. I mean, what, you can look at people and go, why would you want this? 7 out of 10 marriages end in divorce. Why the fuck would you want that?
I don't want to talk to the political aspect of that because I'm such naive when it comes to that, but they would have arguments for you based on that.
I think there's some things that just disturb the shit out of me. Like, you're gay and you can't go visit your loved one in the hospital when they're dying. That doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, that's just stupid. And why somebody would not want them to do that, I find that very disturbing. That's just mean. mean-spirited, and it's just that. That's why that gets back to my point earlier. Why do people kill each other? What does it take to work these people up to the point where they will kill each other? That's one of them. You have to have that dividing line.
I can relate this back to Bruce, a question I talked to like Keith Morris about and a couple of old schooler punks, that the music we create is about being aggressive. And then, and that easily gets interpreted to violence by, you know, in the hands of the wrong people. Do you remember dealing with that? I mean, you're a fairly fast, aggressive band, but you also seem to be, I mean, I can almost make parallels to like you're seeing little wars happen in front of you sometimes because that aggression gets so infectious, you know, and then there's crowd mentality.
That is a big part of it. I don't know how to say it. You see it, you incite it, you start it, you incite it, you get them going, and then you go off on them when they go too far. Because I've done it 1,000,009. What are you doing? Fucking stop it. You just broke somebody's fucking leg. But at the same time, I'm up there doing the crazy fucking song, say, burn it down, motherfucker. And they start burning the fuck down. I got to be the one to stop them. And like it's their fault. But all you got to do is go, yeah, maybe if I had come up here and played Mary Had a Little Lamb, none of this would be happening right now. It's human nature to want to be aggressive, especially when you're young. You're in your 20s. Your testosterone level is way the fuck up here, right? Well, that's what's going to happen. Play violent, fucking aggressive music. Somebody standing in front of you going, fuck you, motherfucker. Kick that motherfucker's ass. What do you fucking think they're going to do? Exactly what they do. And you got no one to blame but myself. And for some reason, I'm good with it. I don't know if it's right or it's fucking wrong, but I'm fucking good with it. That's what I did. That's how people react to it. That's fucking fine.
Well, what is that? I don't know. Is this maybe aggression we have in us? Is that what separates you from? I know you've talked about it. I'm fans of like Fleetwood Mac's Rumors. And, you know, we came out of other scenes of Jethro Tull and music that we were, you know, Circus Magazine. But you chose punk when it came up. So there was something, and not that those scenes can't get violent, but I mean, you know, they probably do. But there's a little bit more passiveness in listening to that music.
That is, that's true. There's a little more passiveness, but there's the same level of the shit that I grew up with those people who listen to Rumors, okay? It's funny you should mention that out, because 2 days before I heard Nevermind the Bollocks for the first time, I was listening to the Rumors album with my mom in the kitchen in her apartment, and her life was fucked up. My life was fucked up, and we were listening to that fucking music. It doesn't mean that shit's not going on. It's going on. You're just not seeing it in front of the band. But that shit, when those people go home, they're going home to the same shit. Okay? It's not just, look at those crazy guys with the mohawks. Their lives must be fucked. It's like, yeah, look at that nice little girl over there, Susie. She's gonna go get fucked by her stepdad in the ass. You know, but you're just not gonna see it. It's not gonna manifest itself when she puts on her little pink dress and goes to school.
So do you think punk rock was uncovering some of that more than rock was? Whereas rock was maybe pacifying it. And I'm generalizing because I love rock music. I love, you know, I love all of it.
What I saw from rock back in the day, I was at the Led Zeppelin show. That was the show in Cincinnati before the Who show, where the people died at the Who show.
Yeah.
I was at the Led Zeppelin show that before that. And it was a human zoo just to get people in. They only would open one gate. There's thousands of people there. Everybody's stoned and drunk out of their fucking minds. People in the back are throwing full quart bottles of beer towards the front to get the line moving. It's hitting people in the head. You're lifting people out, you know, because they're bleeding all over the fucking place. It was a human fucking zoo. And that's rock and roll, right? Everybody was good with that. That's fucking rock and roll. Rock and roll, dude. Mm. And you go to punk rock and somebody's getting beat up in the fucking front row and you're like going, fuck those punk rockers, man. They're fucking violent motherfuckers. Like, I'm sorry, have you been to a rock and roll show, bitch? Did you go to the Who show and I don't know how many people were trampled to fucking death, you know what I mean? They treat you like animals, you react like fucking animals, and that's what happens. You're at a goddamn fucking stadium that has got to have at least 15 gates you can open up to let everybody in, but they only open one because you guys are dogs, and fuck you. We don't care how long it takes to get you dogs in here. We don't have to employ any more people to deal with you fuckers than we want to. They should do is open all the fucking gates, let everybody in just like it's a fucking football game, and everything would be different, wouldn't it? But they can't do that.
The Who concert disaster was a crowd disaster that occurred on December 3rd, 1979, when English rock band The Who performed at Riverfront Coliseum, known now as the Heritage Bank Center, in Cincinnati, Ohio. A rush of concertgoers outside the Coliseum's entry doors resulted in the deaths of 11 people.
They treat you like animals, and that's how people act. It's always been that way. Maybe that's why we fight wars, because they treat us like fucking dogs. When they make us, they tell us who to hate and what to hate, and it just pisses me the fuck off.
Yeah. Channels that aggression that we naturally have within us, you know, in some way.
Well, you know, especially when you're young and you're growing up, you have the aggression anyways. It's inherent. It's inherent in our species. That's how we reproduce, right? The strong male gets the female, and that's how you make the babies. That's your whole goddamn fucking purpose in life. Everything else is window dressing. You're an organism on this planet. You're here to reproduce. After you reproduce, you want your children to reproduce. And when they reproduce, you're supposed to fucking die and go the fuck away. But we don't now. We live way too long. We're living in your 90s. You shouldn't be living past, I don't know, 50-something. That's why there's so many of us on this fucking planet right now.
But you're still here, so you're not... You're not itching to do away with yourself right now. I mean,
no, I just feel bad. I can say I'm a smoker. I've been smoking, you know, since I was fucking 14. I'll be sitting outside taking a break, smoking a cigarette. I can see people like looking at me. Oh, I'm smoking. I'm like, Jesus, give it a rest. I'll be dead soon. You have all your fucking air back. You know what I mean? Fucking hell. I'll stop drinking your water and I'll stop polluting your air with my cigarettes. And you can go back to being a perfectly utopian society.
For the audience that's going to be introduced to this music, and it's going to be a lot easier to get now because of, what was it? Audio Platter did like 4 or 5 of them, and then Beer City Records put out Independence.
Nice segue. Hold on. I just went to JJ's. He sent all this Audio Platter guy, had sent all this stuff to us, right? Apparently JJ's had this for weeks. I just saw him today. Bullets for You, Within These Walls, In the House of God, Kill by Remote Control. No Peace in Our Time. This is the one that Mass did. And then this is a bunch of, I don't know what the fuck this is.
Yeah, I have that original 7-inch. That was the first thing I ever got by you guys was the original.
Yeah, this has 17 songs on it.
Yeah, but that cover is from the 7-inch for God Bless America, right?
Yeah, that's actually, I'm surprised we never got sued for that. That was a political cartoon in the fucking newspaper. I just cut it the fuck out and stuck it on that thing and put God Bless America on it. Yeah, we were punk rock, you know what I mean? We had a cover, got one right here. Cut, here you go.
Yeah, I know. You know, we became, I often talk about, we became our own managers, our own, you know, understanding of, you know, we made our own shirts.
This is the Kill by Remote Control t-shirt. And then this is the that gagged man thing in black.
Wow, that's a good one. I like that
one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'll send it to you.
Yeah.
I feel kind of stupid wearing my own shit, you know what I mean?
Bruce, is there one person in the band that sort of took on the responsibility in getting all these back out again? Or they approach you guys?
Is JJ.
It, yeah, I figured it was JJ.
That was JJ.
Yeah. He's a talker, that guy.
He's a schmoozer. Right? Yeah. Well, Tuffy will do the same thing. You get Tuffy chatting, and next thing you know, it's 2.5 hours later. I'm just the opposite, you know. I'm like, hey, how you doing? I haven't seen you for a while. That's nice. I like your shirt. I got to get back to work. That's just the fucking way I am. But I just noticed today when I was looking at this, all the covers are a little bit darker. But the Bullets for You, instead of being white, the lettering is in gold. Which I thought, wow, that's fucking nice. I did a good job. But they redid the Independence, the black album. They redid that the way it was originally done when me and Skip had laid it out. It was on that. This faux leather, and the back was, we had wrote, Skip had written down all that stuff on the back cover on actual parchment paper. It was supposed to be photographed. It was supposed to be in fucking full color. That's the whole fucking idea. So that you would have a texture on the front and feel like you're touching leather, and then you had the picture on there, and it came out. They're like, how do you guys think this is great? I was like, yeah, okay, sure, fine. You took a Xerox picture of it.
That reminds me of the first Screeching Weasel record. You know, we did all the art ourselves, and one late night before we had to take it to the plant, they said, well, we need you to differentiate what you want red and, you know, because we could do two colors, what you want red and what you want black and white. So we just took a old red marker and did in what we wanted to be red. And they actually did that. They just photocopied the marker. So our first record is just like this scraggly red marker instead of the red we wanted it to be.
That's because they go, Oh, fuck them. You know, they're punk rockers. This might be what they want.
Yeah, they'll get what they get.
And realize that you have a vision in your mind. When I did the cover for Kill by Remote Control, I was very insistent with Rough Trade about the cover. I was like, it has to be in full color. It has to be this image. So I was at work. I was in San Francisco. I worked at a phone calling place. And the guy who had taken my artwork and turned it into that, because he put a gray border and didn't have a border on it before, he brought it down to work where I was. And I looked at it. I was like, damn, dude, that looks fucking sweet. I was just impressed that they were willing to go to that degree, because I knew how expensive it was.
Yeah.
It probably cost more to make that cover than we spent on recording the record. That's probably true. And I was just like thankful. I was like, thank you. Because, you know, what if the unlikely odds that I live to be old enough to have somebody go, you made albums? So yeah, here's one of them right here. And
and it's handwritten to him.
That looks fucking sweet as shit. It's like, well, yeah, that's the whole idea.
So for the audience knows too, the Independence record is on its 40th anniversary this year, September 82.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that makes me feel like a spring chicken.
But that one, I think, was released by Beer City Records separately from the other ones. Is that correct?
Oh, Beer City's released that record more than once.
Yeah, because they that's how I got contact with you. They sent me an email that it was being released. So
it must I haven't seen it yet.
Uh-huh.
It's supposed to be out. I've not gotten a copy of it. All I want to do is see how it looks. That record's been bootlegged and re-released, and I can't imagine why you want to put it out again. It just doesn't make any sense.
Well, this goes to the question that I might ask, and I don't know. I'll ask it, but it might be a stupid question. But you know, we've talked a lot about cynical or maybe you can even call it realistic or pragmatic views of how hard it is to change things. But do you feel any point of pride in them being still valid to somebody now to re-release all of those? That's quite a thing to do. They also re-released like Naked Raygun, and it looks like the Buzzcocks and Dead Kennedys.
Yeah, I'm just grateful to be included in that group of what I consider to be really good bands.
Yeah, of course.
Does that
make
sense?
Yeah.
I always thought we were at least one tier below them, if not two, but be considered with those bands. I'm just flattered.
How does it, I don't know. I think more and more, you know, we used to make fun of, or actually Ben more than I used to make fun of how we would see these aging rock musicians still up there. And we're like, give it up. Don't do it. You know? And I think I always had sort of an inkling, like, we're going to be those people someday. You know,
if you're lucky enough, If you're lucky enough to live that long, you are going to be that old fucker up there on the stage. And everybody's going to go, wow, motherfucker got fat. Voice sounds like shit.
When you have a meta moment on stage, like when you're playing with Europe or whatever, you're playing these songs from like 30, 40 years ago, what gets you through that? Is there energy still for you that makes it worthwhile? Are you just trying to get that check? Are you, you know, you're just trying to do something before you die?
Honestly, I look at the crowd. And I make eye contact. I can't help it. That's just who I am. I don't hide from the fact that I know I'm not the best guitar player in the world. I get it. I know that. But there are people out there who want to see me play. And I do. I mean, before we have to go do like a couple of years ago, we did some shows over in England. I rehearsed endlessly here at home at stage volume. Sorry, attendants, but that's just the way it is. And I just want to make them happy. Because I appreciated them being there all those times after, you know, all those years. And I owe that to them, you know, instead of just showing up and going like, you know what, just give me some money. Fuck this shit. I'm fucking out of here. It's like, no, I would almost kill myself every night we played those shows when we went to England. I'd be dizzy from screaming so loud and doing my best because I'm an old man. I've been smoking for 40 years. You know what I mean? Now I got a different problem now. Since then, my arthritis has gotten worse, and it's actually excruciating.
Hey, man.
And I haven't not played guitar. We played a show in Dayton, Ohio, and last summer. I haven't played my guitar since then. We got Vess from the Zero Boys is playing with us now. He's been in a band called Lemonheads too.
The name is Vess Ruttenberg. And he's been in such bands as Gentle Readers, Many Bright Things, Over the Rhine, The Pieces, Zero Boys, and filling in Toxic Reasons.
He's playing with us now. And he's like, what do you want me to do on the guitar solo part? I say, play the guitar solo.
Everything.
Yeah, play the fucking guitar solo. I can't wiggle my fingers to save my fucking life. I've just taken an entire week off and taken ibuprofen just because I think it's becoming detrimental to me, just because if I take 3 ibuprofen a day, then 3 months from now I have to take 6 ibuprofen a day, you know what I mean? Then I'm take a couple weeks off from that and live with the pain a little bit worse, and then take 2 or 3 or something like that, you know what I mean? I don't know what I'm going to do. I mean, if Europe is still there and we have to go over there next summer, I still have my doubts whether they're going to be there or not.
Do you feel you're the type of person that would give it just like give into your guttural fortitude and just stop knowing that you're getting worse, or you're going to just play until you can't anymore?
No, I swear to God, like I said, I know I'm not that good of a guitar player. I have to work really hard to do the stupidest simple things that other guys that you can watch them play and they'd be like laughing at. This guy's a chump, which is fine. I like being a chump. I like playing my fucking guitar. I will do that. I swear to God, I'll be standing on stage. I'll be crying and going, fucking can't do this anymore. That's what I'll stop. It's like Paul Mahern told me. He goes, you know what? You are the guy who should probably die on stage. I thought that was the biggest compliment ever given me. I was like, dude, that's fucking sweet. Thank you. He told me that. He told me that to my face. He said, you define rock and roll. He goes, you should probably be the one guy that dies on stage. I was like, wow. Now I feel obligated to go die on stage. You know what I mean? I thought that was the creepiest, nicest thing anyone's ever said to me.
Yeah. No, knowing Paul, I could see the relevance and the thought and the black humor, but also the seriousness of that statement.
Yeah. And I took that to heart. I mean, that's, like I said, it's one of the nicest things anyone's ever said to me. That's as nice as someone, you know, as you know, getting that girl that you're in love with to say that she loves you back. You know what I mean? That was just as nice hearing that. It was for me anyway. Like I said, because I just told you something about my past so that you can understand how difficult it is for me to have relationships and things like that of that nature.
Yeah. I'm going to wrap it up here, Bruce, but I don't know. I feel like even though you've talked about it, honestly, I don't know what more I want. What is it like now with you and Tufty? And, you know, you're working for Tufty. It's not even, you know, like you said, they're family. They're not even, and family, one thing about family that people don't often see is that doesn't mean you're always get along. It means that you know the bads and the goods of a person and you're willing to be there for them when they're being bad, and you're willing to be there for them when they're good.
And you know when to say something and when not to say something. That's how well we know each other. I mean, me and Tufty and JJ, you could put us in a room, turn off the lights, be pitch fucking dark, one of us would fart, the other two would know who it was. That's how close we are. Yeah, God damn it, JJ. No, I just, I don't know. I don't take my relationship with Tufty and JJ in the context of just the toxic relationship, okay?
Well, that's why I bring it up. And that's the stuff that's always important to me is what goes beyond the music.
Yeah, this is our daily relationship has nothing to do with that. Mm-hmm. And the fact that Tufty's always trying to, because he's a planner, you know what I mean? He's the reason we went to Europe all those times, because he's a planner and he's a saver. We would save money, we'd plan, and we'd fucking go do it. But that was 90% of that was him. The rest of us were just like going, sure, whatever. Especially me. It's like, what the fuck else am I going to do? Stay in the truck here when you guys fly over there, and I'll sleep at O'Hare or at JFK Airport for 6 months. I'll go with you. I don't know. It's just we've gotten to the point now. I'm sure you've seen pictures of us, right? I mean, you're looking at me right now. I'm almost 63 years old. JJ's younger than me. Tufty's older than me. He's 65. It's not a good idea to go and do what we did before. It's not a thing to do. Mm. It has to be different. We need a place to crash. I can't sleep on the stage. Does that make sense?
No, that's exactly what I was getting at earlier when I asked about, like, what is it like being now and being in front of an audience? And it is different. We have to admit it, you know. God damn it, the music we did is some of the most energetic in the world. And now we still have to be here.
I don't want to get back on that motherfucking stage after 30 years and disappoint everybody. That's the last thing I want to do. because I don't like to sit there and stare at my guitar. Whenever I see a picture of me staring at my guitar, I get pissed off. He's like, either you don't know how to take a picture or I'm being a lazy ass motherfucker. One of the two. But I want to be able to look in people's eyes and I don't want them to be going like, oh, you're old. Oh, are you okay? You know what I mean? I want them looking at me going like, fuck yeah, motherfucker. That's what the fuck I remember. And if I can't do that, then I don't want to fucking do it.
And hopefully you'll die on stage.
Yeah, then everybody can say, hey, he was old and skinny and burned out, but motherfucker died on stage. I'll take it, motherfucker. You feel me?
Yeah. Bruce, I'm probably going to end it there, but I still want to go back and ask this one last thing, if you don't mind.
Of course.
I'm always, and other interviewers have been fascinated with this Canadian, American, and UK people working together in a band. And then you're also dealt a lot with political stuff. Did it, I don't know, in some way empower you to feel like you were like a little bit more objective because you had like most bands didn't have that. You know, you were American or you were like a Canadian band, you know, Teenage Head or you UK band. You had this, and even though they all were living in America for the longest time, I mean, eventually, did you feel like you had something different that you could say politically that had more ground to it or more validity or objectivity?
No. It would be nice to say, sure, yeah, you know, we have these different political points of view, but everybody had been, JJ was too young to give a Canadian perspective on things, just totally Canadian.
Yeah, yeah.
And Rob and Tufty had lived in America since they were teenagers, so most of what they're singing about is from the American educational point of view, you know what I mean? Yeah. You get indoctrinated into the system and then you rebel. There's your rebellion thing. It comes from realizing that what you're being taught are lies. And then there's me, who's just an idiot. I told you, I barely got out of fucking high school. Mm. But I knew early on, when you listen to the history, you just go like, well, that's fucking bullshit. Everybody said, yeah, yeah, yeah. We're going to kill the Nazis. We killed the Indians. We killed everybody. It's like, well, why did we do that? And nobody ever said why. Said, well, they were bad. And you get older, you go, I think we did a lot of killing too.
And yeah, we might have something to do with that.
Yeah, maybe we shouldn't have killed all those Indians and maybe we shouldn't have, you know, killed all those other people and all those school children. And you start asking yourself these questions and it's really easy to turn that off. I'm not going to ask those questions. I'm going to hate the fags. If it wasn't for them, this country would be fucking great, wouldn't it? I'm going to hate the Republicans because if it wasn't for them, this country would be fucking great. I'm going to hate, you know, just fucking pick
keep going one, on right? And on and on. Yeah, yeah.
All the way down the list. You know, every day there'll be something new. There'll be a new fucking disaster, something else you can fucking hate on and revel about and scream about. But at the end of the day, it's just you, dude. You're the one who's being lazy. You're not putting in the fucking work. You got to sit back and go, it's not everybody else. Mm. That's why it's called the United States. It's us. Mm. Me and you, it's us. We are the ones who let them do this.
I at least, and I feel like some part of you, and that's why I talk about these friends and that there's something about community. There's something about the small world that makes it worthwhile to me. You know, that,
you know what makes it all worthwhile to me?
What?
I hate to sound trite and stupid. But today, I gotta tell you, I'm not a smart guy. I'm not an intellectual by any stretch of anyone's imagination. I was at Meijer today after I went to JJ's and picked up all that shit I just showed you. I think I'll stop and get a frozen pizza and buy some vodka, you know what I mean? I got my cart and I'm going around, and there's a lot of people in there. And all of a sudden, this dun, fucking Christmas song comes out. And like an idiot, I'm not even thinking. I do this at work all the time. I start whistling the song. Dun, dun, dun. I'm whistling around. I start singing along with it. And I'm looking for some orange juice to go with my vodka, you know. And all of a sudden, I look up and then people are staring at me. And but most of them are smiling. Because for some reason, they're like going, look at this fucking idiot. but he seems really fucking happy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I look at him, I smile back. And I keep singing my song and whistling, grab my shit and keep moving on. And every time I come out, somebody could come down the aisle and they'd see me whistling. They'd be, oh, hey, how you doing? I'd say, hey, how you doing? That's community, right? Those little things. When you smile at somebody that you've never fucking even seen before in your life and go, oh, I like your jacket. Oh, that's a cool shirt. It makes a huge fucking difference, dude. Those are the battles I fight. The battles for the good. That's the only thing I can think of to do that means anything to anybody, because I find that to be infectious, and that's something that they can spread like a virus. I'm all about that.
Bruce, that was the ending I was looking for.
Good. I appreciate this. This is very kind.
Thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it. I'm sorry. I'm a rambling old man, but this is very fun. Thank you.
Bye-bye, Bruce. See you.
Bye.
Bye.
If you have made it this far, you just got done listening to Sons of Freedom by Toxic Reasons off the album Within These Walls, originally released in 1985 and just recently released in 2022 by Audio Platter. This is actually one of my favorite records, which is not one of their favorite records. I was actually told this at their show that they played for us many years ago. But as referred to in the Paul Mahern episode, this record has increased in popularity over the years. They were a little bit ahead of the curve with the new wavy sort of feel they were doing. And even though they went back to their more hardcore, only slightly melodic music, this one still sticks out for me as a classic record. Speaking of that, I had mentioned in the beginning, if you choose to become a patron at www.jugheadsbasementpodcast.com at the $5 or $10 tiers and pay for a full year in advance, which is either $51 or $100 and something, you get a 10% discount for paying the full year. If you do that and you are in the continental USA, if you are the first one to respond, first one only, I will send you this full collection of Toxic Reasons. The first record, Independence, is on vinyl, and the rest of the collection is on CD, which includes Bullets for You, God Bless America, the compilation, Within These Walls, Kill by Remote Control, No Place in Our Time, and In the House of God. So, if you are the first one, after listening to this podcast, to sign up at the yearly rate at either $5 or $10 tiers, you will receive this in your mail. Upcoming, we will have John Giannoli talking about The Outnumbered and Pansy Division, and I am working on interviews for, and it is exciting if they pull through. I'm working on an interview with Joey Shithead from DOA and also Sam McFeeters, who is in Born Against and who is also a writer of fiction and nonfiction. So there it is, everybody. Join the Patreon, help out however you can, and live wisely. Goodbye. For now.